You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Every nation has a responsibility to do its part if we're going to pass this test. And only those nations who step up and respond to this threat can legitimately lay claim to any mantle of leadership and global responsibility.
John Kerry fulminating from the Lima Climate Conference to the consequences of the US Senate's investigation into the CIA to Australia's proposals for constitutional recognition of its Aboriginal people. We'll cover the day's big talking points with special guests Martin Plaut and Oscar Juadiola Rivera. We'll also meet one of the neighbours of our new Tokyo bureau.
It's a wonderful neighbourhood to be in. The Prime Minister lives up the road, so sometimes he drives by. Suddenly everything will turn really, really quiet, and there he passes by.
And then... We'll review the latest offerings from Bollywood, all that, and a check-in with our man in Milan coming up right now on Midori House on Monocle 24. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley is here with the latest world news.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has left Northern Ireland today without a deal to end months of political deadlock over financial and cultural disputes in the province. Britain called all-party talks 9 weeks ago aimed at breaking an impasse over budget cuts among Belfast's power-sharing government and settling other divisive issues like parading and the flying of flags. Northern Ireland's First Minister Peter Robinson said the parties need to reach a deal before Christmas as they would be less likely to make the necessary compromise afterwards with general elections to the British Parliament expected by May.
I don't believe that we sufficiently challenged the Prime Minister in relation to what his bottom line was on financial issues. And we didn't do that because we had not ourselves been able to complete agreement on other aspects of the financial issues, namely the matter of welfare reform. And I think that the Prime Minister would have had more give in him if he had seen that that issue was going to be resolved.
Meanwhile, London's Heathrow Airport said in a statement that London's airspace is now open and flights are now arriving and departing again after they were grounded earlier today due to an air traffic control failure that affected all of London's airports. London's Luton Airport also said flights were resuming. British airports were plunged into chaos by a technical failure that forced authorities to restrict access to the country's airspace. Environmental ministers from France, Germany and Spain have called for countries to make binding commitments and set long-term strategies to combat climate change. They're in Peru's capital, Lima, for UN-backed climate talks which aim to set draft elements for a deal to limit rising world greenhouse gas emissions. The final meeting is due to take place in Paris next year. Well, the US Secretary of State John Kerry arrived at the talks urging a common approach.
More than half of global emissions, more than half, are coming from developing nations. So it is imperative that they act too. And at the end of the day, if nations do choose the energy sources of the past over the energy sources of the future, they'll actually be missing out on the opportunity to build the kind of economy that will be the economy of the future and that will thrive and be sustainable.
Pope Francis will not meet the exiled Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, because of the delicate situation with China, the Vatican said today. The Dalai Lama, who is visiting Rome, had requested a meeting. A Vatican spokesman said that although the Pope held him in very high regard, the request had been declined for obvious reasons. Correspondents say the Vatican doesn't want to jeopardize efforts to improve relations with China. And a vigil was held at the Washington National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. today to remember all the victims of gun violence just ahead of Sunday's second anniversary of the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The very Reverend Gary Hall is Dean of the National Cathedral.
The Newtown shootings also occurred in a year when urban gun violence in Chicago had reached startling proportions. Enough, we said, is enough. The gun lobby is no match for the cross lobby.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London, nearly 18.06, which will be 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have Martin Plaut, Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Oscar Juadiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University here in London, both Monocle 24 regulars. Welcome back. Now, first of all, among the outrage that attended this week's release of the US Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into abuses committed by the CIA following September 11th, one response rang truer than most. Senator John McCain, who learnt the hard way about the depravity and futility of torturing prisoners during the years he spent as a POW in Hanoi, said it isn't about our enemies, it's about us. It's about who we were, who we are, who we aspire to be. It's about how we represent ourselves to the world. Oscar, I'll ask you first, is McCain right? Does this damage America's moral authority?
I think he's absolutely right, and I thought his reaction was exemplary. And coming from someone who is perceived around the world as a hawk, as someone whose views are very well known on these subjects, I think is good to hear that indeed this is about not past history, as some have put it, but it is about what we are, not only Americans, but us in the world. Are we going to justify torture because it seems it may have been useful, or are we going to take the principled decision that torture is unjustifiable, come what may?
It is interesting. There does seem to have been a twin-tracked response. There's been the people who've said that, the people who've been outraged by the report, there's been two responses. One is that torturing prisoners is just wrong, that torture is just wrong. And there's other people who've taken the more utilitarian perspective and said, apart from anything else, it just doesn't actually work. Which is certainly, when I've had this conversation with people who have worked in the police, in intelligence services, that's what they say. The trouble is, if you torture people, they will tell you anything.
Exactly. And the problem with that argument is that it is an insult to utilitarians. In fact, Jeremy Bentham himself took on that argument, and he condemned anyone who would say that any information obtained by means of torture would be useful. And the issue is completely logical. Of course, if you're being subjected to torture, you will say whatever they want you to say. And that's the point. So the CIA director is wrong in telling us that it is unknowable whether or not such information could be useful. As Senator Feinstein put it very correctly, it can be known, and that's precisely what the report does. It tells us that none of that information was crucial. And then to go on and say that there may be some value to that information and it may have led to this or that detention or this or that life being saved, it leaves us nowhere, because to say that it may be or may not is something that we can neither be falsified nor confirmed. And that is the kind of language that George Orwell, of course, would have condemned.
Martin Plaut, does it damage America's authority? And I guess I'll ask you the same question another way, because does this report, horrific though some of the details are, does it actually tell us anything we didn't already know or mightn't have guessed?
Well, I think that what one has to look at is the reaction that there's been around the world to this. Yes, obviously it does. Although, as the Americans themselves pointed out, at least we admit it. You know, we're open about it. We publish a huge report about it. And certainly in Europe, there has been a sense of shock that the Americans are doing this. But if you look at, I actually went around and looked at all the African newspapers. I looked at the Namibian, the Monitor, New Vision in Uganda, Punch in Nigeria, Star and Standard in Kenya. Not a sausage about it. It was not a story. And the extraordinary thing is, in most of the Middle Eastern newspapers, Al-Quds, Al-Arabi, and all those kind of major newspapers, yes, they carried it as a story inside.
Well, of course not. I mean, think about what a report, that kind of report would have said if it had been made in the Middle East. So no wonder they don't.
Well, yes, but I think it actually, what it shows is something rather different. In Kenya, for example, there have been stories for years that people are being tortured just north of them in Somalia by the CIA in black ops operations and so forth. This is not new. They knew about this. And after all, how much of this is new to any of us? We've all seen it in films. We've seen it in, we've seen reports about. Did you not hear about waterboarding before this report?
Well,
we all knew about it. So the big deal is that the Americans officially accept that they were doing it. The idea that they were doing it is not news.
But wait a second, because there is something additional there. Of course, we have to praise the American system. The checks and balances did work. We have a sector of the Senate being able to tell us that this is the truth. We have to praise Americans and the American model of politics for allowing that sort of thing. But it's not the case that just because we knew that this was going on, then the report isn't important. It is very important because it makes it absolutely official that this is happening, that this happened in America. There is also the kind of reaction that you got in my part of the world, in Latin America, when we hear about waterboarding, which was originally known as El Submarino. You know, you begin to trace the global history of this.
Look, exactly. I completely accept what you're saying.
The two protagonists of the report, a couple of Latino, one guy with a Latino name who learned his trade in Latin America, the other a named head of torture who learned his trade in Latin America in the 80s. So for us, this is absolutely relevant.
But I completely accept this. The problem is it a surprise? I completely agree with you that
not
it
a
is
surprise,
horrific, but it's not
still
a surprise.
A scandal.
But let me tell you what the big story is in Kenya. The big story in Kenya has been the fact that protesters brought 20 donkeys into the center of Nairobi, sprayed with the words, "We're fed up." That is the front page news.
Well,
I'm afraid,
maybe that tells us more about the reality of news gathering than anything else.
But Oscar, you mentioned Latin America, and obviously this report by the Senate appears the same week that Brazil's National Truth Commission releases its report into crimes committed under its dictatorship. And this, of course, goes back 30 years. America is looking at a rather more recent period in its history. What's your sense of thinking of the Brazilian report? Does it, and it's not the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission of this sort. They've been fairly fashionable the last few decades. I think the South African one was the pioneering example. Do they help? Or are countries, to take a slightly more, even ruthless view, are countries just better off just forgetting this stuff and moving on?
Look, they prosecute those who are still alive and were involved in torture during the dictatorship. Only then this kind of report will be useful. If it is just another piece of paper that will be forgotten tomorrow, then it is completely useless. Let me finish by mentioning two contrasting reactions. While in the case of the United States, we heard many officials, including President Obama himself, saying, oh, well, it is worth reopening this wound of the past. This was a case that should be left in the past. The Brazilian Secretary of Justice, Paulo Abreu, said, we cannot say that this is something that is still in the past, because for the families of those victims whose cases have not been heard, this is very much a case of the present. And also, there is a more important geopolitical point here. Many of the kinds of torture, I already mentioned waterboarding, but also the kind of torture that was described in the U.S. Senate report, hanging someone from a pole, that has a name in Portuguese. And again, there is a sense in which because we do not learn of these things in the past, we keep repeating them.
Okay, well, I want to move along on a similar story, I guess, about dealing with the past, and that's looking at Australia, where the Prime Minister Tony Abbott has announced his intention to confront his country's original sin, which is, of course, the dispossession of its Indigenous peoples. This is a conversation that has ebbed and flowed since Australia's bicentennial in 1988 between those who believe that Australia should apologise, which did eventually happen during the premiership of Kevin Rudd, and those who decry what is often dismissed as a black armband view of history. Abbott wants a referendum in 2017 on constitutional recognition of Australian Aboriginals. Martin, how important is a symbolic gesture like this? I mean, all the statistical analyses of life for Australian Aboriginals are dreadful and shocking and a source of ongoing embarrassment and shame, I think, to every Australian. This is obviously a symbolic gesture. How much difference is it going to make?
Well, I think you as an Australian are in a better position to answer that question than I would be. You know, I'm always dubious about these kind of things. Not that I'm opposed to them. I think it's an excellent idea to apologise occasionally for things, but not to do it all the time. After all, you know, should the Brits start demanding that the Italians apologise for the invasion of the Romans? I mean, you know, there's a point at which you don't want to do this. There's just absolutely no point in going back too far in all of these things. But if there are people who generally are still affected by it, then absolutely there should be this kind of attrition. But, you know, I am just a bit cynical about this. Tony Abbott is, as I understand it, deeply unpopular at the moment in Australia.
Not without reason.
And, you know, this kind of thing is when you have nothing else to do. I mean, let me just give you a South African example. When they have nothing else to do in South Africa, they rename a road. They take some apartheid hero that was given a road and they name it after one of the liberation heroes. Great idea. Takes everybody's mind off things. It doesn't change a damn thing. And, you know, that's my feeling about this kind of thing. It's symbolic manipulation. Always important, but it has to be done for the right reasons and at the right time. If something goes with it and there's a genuine change in relationship between the white Australians and the Aborigines, fine. But if it's just going to be a sort of sorry, well, what's the point?
Oscar, South America is largely a continent of what might be termed settler nations. It was a continent founded again on dispossession of Indigenous peoples. How great a source of tension is that still in Latin American countries today?
It is still a source of tension, not only in South America, but in the entire American continent.
Well, indeed.
What is remarkable is the Canadian leading intellectual John Ralston Saul calls the comeback of Aboriginal peoples in Canada and south of the border of the U.S. There is a sense that after 2000, these communities were, in the brink of extinction and civilizational instability, have been making a comeback. And you could not understand what is happening with the politics of places like Ecuador or Bolivia, even Brazil, and also Colombia and Mexico. Apache, there are different ideological, orientations, but also in Canada, if not because Aborigines are making a comeback. But I'm in complete agreement with Martin. It is solely when Aborigines themselves have organized politically and acquire enough strength so as to begin to ask for a restorative justice of a constructive kind when these sort of gestures matter. Otherwise, they do not.
Yeah, I think that the one thing one should bear in mind is that this is a preoccupation of white Anglo-Saxons. If you take the situation in India, you have the scheduled tribes, whoever hears about them. Nearly 9% of the population, they are the indigenous peoples of the Indian subcontinent who were dominated by the Aryans who arrived, and then later by the Mughals. You never hear a word about them, and I can assure you that the Aryans are not going to go around apologizing to them. You take the Bushmen in South Africa, who used to be called San. The Bushmen were exterminated and hunted by whites, but they were also hunted and exterminated by the Bantu-speaking peoples who arrived many years after they did. Are you going to ever hear Mr. Zuma saying that he's sorry to the Bushmen? I don't think so.
Well, before we take a short break, we should also take a quick look at the climate talks taking place in Lima. US Secretary of State John Kerry, ever the life and soul, has said the world is still on a course leading to tragedy. A key split, as ever, is between the wealthy countries who've already pillaged the environment to achieve economic prosperity and the poorer countries who'd quite like to. Oscar, John Kerry says no country should get a free pass anymore. Is he right?
Well, I think he's right in saying that we're all in this together, and if we keep the course, we're leading for disaster. But it has to be said that the principle of differentiation, which has led these talks, should be still taken into account, because it's not the same historical case for developed and developing countries. And also, most important of all, we now know that most of the responsibility, the moral responsibility at least, is in the hands of countries like Colombia or Peru, and the Amazon is there, and so on and so forth. So what we need to do what we need is two things. On the one hand, a global perspective. We need to decide as humanity as such. We know that if we keep our current economic outlook, nothing we do will change this course of action. But also, it is the case that we need to make financial and economic choices. And those have to be made between developed and developing countries. And in this respect, the apportioning of the blame and the responsibility for the future cannot be the same.
Martin, it's not an ideal week for the US to be lecturing the world about moral responsibility, is it?
It isn't, but then when was an ideal week?
Yeah, when wasn't?
On the other hand, we all know that if the Chinese don't take their share of the burden, and sure, if the Indians don't take their share of the burden, whatever we do in the West is going to be not enough. So, I mean, frankly, yes, we must do more than they must, but they must do their bit as well. There's no other way around it.
I mean, the problem always strikes me that climate change is a long-term problem, and politicians tend to be short-term thinkers.
That's it.
Yeah, but the technology is moving fast. And I'm actually quite hopeful about that we will get somewhere.
I think we should be more alarmed. We should be on Kerry's side with this one. No matter the kind of technology that we have not produced the kind of technology, and we will not produce the kind of technology. Every single scientific report tells us that we'll solve this question as if it were by magic. So actually, we are in dire straits when it comes to this already.
Not by magic, but a couple of weeks ago, 40% of all the energy in Britain was produced by wind power. Unthinkable 10 years ago.
Absolutely. That's great. It is great that Uruguay is near 100% of production of its energy using renewable sources. That's the course. That's where
and
we should go.
And let's not forget it, that great little country, Bhutan, 100% electricity through hydroelectricity.
That's the
great
answer.
Great country.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Martin Plaut and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. When we return, we will be opening Monocle's latest publication, The Forecast.
The Cafe Pacific experience is one of ease and exploration, introducing a contemporary Asian experience to international travel. By placing service at its core, Cafe Pacific evolves with its passengers, creating a home away from home in its lounges and aircraft. Having built its name on service and quality, Cafe Pacific has helped turn its Hong Kong home into a premier transport hub, making the airline one of the world's leading aviation brands. Find out how Cafe Pacific is flying into 2015 and get the view beyond the horizon in The Forecast, the brand new magazine from the editors and bureau of Monocle.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Martin Plaut and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, on a newsstand near you now, Unmissable in its iridescent salmon sleeve is the newest publication from Monocle. The Forecast, as the name suggests, will be an annual look ahead to the imminent year. One of the reports in this first issue focuses on Brazil, a country famous for many things, not so much for its food, which prompts the question of how important national cuisine is to a country's soft power. Is Italy helped by the fact that everyone like spaghetti, is Britain hindered by enduring stereotypes of warm beer and cold soup? Martin, do you think national cuisines, many of which you must have sampled by now, do they reflect national character, or are we just imposing our own stereotypes on them?
Well, before we get there, I've got to defend British beer. There's absolutely nothing better than a good pint.
That's
so let's
true.
Leave that one aside.
Very true.
Well, listen, I can say is that I'm hemispherically prejudiced. If I go to the East, between Italy and Japan, I adore the cuisine. And, you know, I've sampled lots of it, everything from, you know, Indian curries to, you know, Thai food, Japanese. When I go West, I have never had a good meal. You know, that's probably not true. I mean, I've had good Japanese food in San Francisco, and I've eaten good salmon steaks, which I caught myself in Alaska. So, you know, I have had some good food. But, you know, Tex-Mex is just sludge on a plate. I have never had a decent American meal, you know, indigenous American meal. Now, Jorge, I'd love to know, what is it that I have missed? Where can I get it in London?
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Latin American food, American food, defend the cuisine of the Western Hemisphere, if you will.
I was suggesting to Martin that he should go to a restaurant in the East End of London, which serves really good Peruvian food. Peruvian food is probably the one that we should, we Latin Americans would defend, because it's a beautiful mixture of Japanese cuisine and Latin American indigenous cuisine.
I should state for the record that a friend of mine went to Peru recently and sampled the local cuisine on his first night in Lima and spent the next week in hospital.
You have to ask him where he went.
But you could have that in London too.
Well, that is.
But that's it. But when it comes to Brazilian food. Well, the food in Bahia is interesting, but when it comes to the so-called national dish, feijoada, well, you would find a version of it in pretty much every single Latin American country, and it's not a really nice dish. So,
do you have any actual favorite national cuisines away from South America?
Yes, I do. I think Martin is right. Eastern cuisine is much better. I think the Japanese got it.
I mean, and how important do you think they are in selling a nation? Do some national cuisines strike you as more sellable than others?
Yes, I would say that Ethiopian injera is extremely difficult to sell to anybody else. I absolutely adore it three or four months. It's not something I want to eat every day, but it is absolutely delicious. But you couldn't sell it to anybody else. It is, you know, I mean, if anybody's seen it, it looks like tripe. Quite frankly, it is pancakes made with fermented, teff if it is properly made, with sorghum if it's not properly made. And then you have little curries on top of it and you eat it like a pancake with your hands. It is absolutely delicious. But I've never known anybody except an Ethiopian or an Eritrean producing it well.
Weirdly, I have to say, one of the best in-flight meals I've ever eaten was in business class on Ethiopian Airlines.
You always go business class, do you?
Unfortunately, I don't know. That particular trip, I benefited from a certain amount of confusion at the check-in desk, which I took shameless advantage of. But no, but the injera and curries on Ethiopian Airlines were very, very good.
They're a good airline.
Do you think there are some that are more sellable than others? I mean, obviously, Japan has hugely sold itself to the world through its cuisine, especially in the last 10 or 20 years. Are there underrated ones? Are there things we should be paying more attention to?
Well, I do believe that, as I said, Bahian Brazilian cuisine is underrated. It's pretty good. The way what they do with shellfish and so on is brilliant. But of course, there are easier things to sell. Argentinians, for instance, all they have is meat. It's very simple. Good meat.
The steaks are good. It. Steak and red wine. They're good at both of those things.
That's it. Well, now the wine. That's the thing. That was going to be my point. Let's move from food to drinks, and there we have an interesting discussion. Latin Americans win.
You can make a case for South Africa on that front as well. Most assuredly,
the wine is great, and I would stand up for South African boerewors.
Good.
Which is a sausage. It's a spicy sausage. Personally, I don't know if anybody's ever tried biltong. It's a dried fillet.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's pretty disgusting, especially when you've seen the flies settling on it. Not something I'd eat. But the cuisine that I absolutely could eat every single day is what the Nepalis call dal bhat, which is just the sort of rice and lentils and vegetables. Absolutely delicious. perfectly cooked by every Nepali mother. Just wonderful, wonderful cooking.
Handmade bread in Jaipur in India. Brilliant.
Okay, so Jaipur in Nepal, the subcontinent, appears to be the locus. We will have to leave it there, and I'm now suddenly extremely hungry myself. Martin Plowden and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, as always, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still coming up in the second half of today's show. We'll be catching up with our man in Milan. We'll continue our tour of our new neighbourhood in Tokyo and catch up with the latest Bollywood releases. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley is here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has left Northern Ireland today without a deal to end months of political deadlock over financial and cultural disputes in the province. Meanwhile, London's Heathrow Airport said in a statement today that London's airspace is now open and flights are now arriving and departing again after they were grounded earlier today due to an air traffic control failure that affected all of London's airports. Environmental ministers from France, Germany and Spain have called for countries to make binding commitments and set long-term strategies to combat climate change. They're in Lima, in Peru, for a UN-backed climate talks, which are aimed to set draft elements for a deal to limit rising world greenhouse gas emissions. And Pope Francis has just announced that he will not meet the exiled Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, because of the very delicate situation with China, the Vatican has said. The Dalai Lama, who is visiting Rome, had requested that meeting. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 16:32 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Milan, from where we're joined by Ivan Cavallo. Ivan, welcome to the show. Nothing much happening in Italy today, apparently.
Indeed not. We've had strikes interrupting service and transport and police battling with demonstrators. Here in Milan, you can hear helicopters flying over, and basically it's a long weekend for some people, and others are just being frustrated by trying to get home on a subway that's now closed.
This is a more or less general strike. What is it protesting against, and who's called it?
Yeah, this has been in the works for a few months. Two of the three biggest unions decided to strike today. And it's against Matteo Renzi's labor reforms, his so-called Jobs Act, to sort of shake up the labor market in Italy to create a more flexible system of hiring and firing, and to try to get workers on the same level, the older generation, the younger generation, on the same sort of equal footing. And it's been contentious, and there's a lot of angry people saying that, you know, older generation worried about some securities. The youth unemployment's very high, and people are worried about what these changes could bring. And so you see that in some of these demonstrations today.
Is it possible to tell which way public sympathy is tending?
Well, I think that for the moment, Renzi still manages to hold on to an approval rating, which he feels, you know, still confident. I mean, he was able to pass in a no confidence vote, you know, this legislation. He had some defections, you know, in the lower chamber from his Democratic Party who abstained, members of the PD party. A couple even voted against it. But he's thinking that he can ride this out, because when you look at the opposition right now, there's not a lot. Beppe Grillo is sort of quite fatigued and within his own party, which has lost 20 members through being thrown out. And dissenters, that there is still no one that can really pull together a vote and win a reform as Renzi can right now. So I don't think there's much, you know, really alternative out there.
I want to return as well to a subject I know we have talked about before, and this is, it does seem in many respects somewhat facile to talk about a corruption scandal in Italy, because it does often seem that Italian politics is nothing but one long corruption scandal. But this one is particularly impressive even by local standards. What's the latest?
Well, in this Mafia Capitale, as they're talking about it in the press, in Rome, and how this these contracts for various tenders for whether it's immigration centers to set up asylum centers for immigrants and other things, this local mafia, which now they're saying that there are reports that there have been some of these were gangsters, you know, originally from the 1970s. There was this one-eyed bandit, so there's a lot of these colorful stories coming out that they actually also have some ties to the southern Italian mafias, like the 'Ndrangheta and so on, and because it's even gotten into Renzi's Democratic Party, there's a lot of concern right now. And Renzi, of course, this week is talking about severe penalties, you know, jail terms, and his anti-corruption czar is talking about trying to set up, like, both seizing assets, which is really the key to make it hurt economically for these people, also a rating system, if you can believe this, a corruption rating system to sort of rate those companies that are less corrupt. So it's like if you have a 3-star rating, you're okay to win a public contract. I don't know how that's going to work, though.
Just finally and briefly, we should talk about the I don't know whether you describe them as upheavals, perhaps ructions, but the Giannini's are leaving Gucci.
Yes, indeed. Frida Giannini, for those who don't know her, she is the designer of Gucci and has been there for quite a long time, over a decade at a fashion house, which is, I think, quite impressive, coming after the Tom Ford era. And this came out today, this news. There had been some talk about it in the last year. You know, Gucci's sales are down. It had its weakest quarterly growth in, I think, 4 years. And there's a tendency now, when you look at Asia, which is everyone's thinking about Asia, whether it's luxury and so on, to grow, there's sort of been a bit of backlash to the logos, and they're trying to promote, you know, new things in Asia. And the management of Kering, the French group that owns Gucci, believes that there needs to be a change at the top, creatively, to sort of go into a new direction to get that Asian market back for them.
Has Gucci sort of oversold itself? Has it become perceived as, I don't know, somewhat naff?
I think that, you know, with Giannini, she was very much into the heritage, going back through the archives, going through different decades, always something new, but it was sort of jumping around a lot. And I think in today's age, there wants to be sort of what the buyers are looking for are sort of a slow sort of transformation. And she was really all over the map, going into Gucci's equestrian heritage, bringing in someone from the Monaco family, you know Charlotte Casareggi as a spokesperson. So I think that the management at Kering want somebody who can really put a real firm signature on it without this sort of, I mean, she was very creative, but she was jumping around a lot. You know, she was good in the 60s and 70s sort of looks, but, you know, she liked to move around too much. And I think they feel that they need to have something that's a bit more of continuity from season to season.
Ivan Cavalho in Milan, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be meeting some more of our neighbours in Tokyo.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
18:39 here in London. Now, in October, which was all of 2 months ago now, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau moved to the Tomigaya area. Since then, our staff have been introducing themselves to their new neighbours. Today, they're heading around the corner to Fuglen. Three Norwegians started Fuglen in the more predictable environs of Oslo in 2008 and opened their Tokyo branch 2 years ago. It's a cafe, a furniture shop, and a cocktail bar. We drop by the shop on a busy Monday morning for a chat with barista Natasha Vik.
Hi, my name is Natasha and I work at Fuglen in Tokyo. The store has three main aspects. It's espresso bar, cocktail bar, and vintage. So the store has three owners, one specializing in each one of those aspects. Fuglen seats about 25, 26 people inside, and then we also have benches outside which you can use. Winter in Tokyo is fairly mild, so people tend to use it in the winter as well. The interior is all Norwegian 50s, 60s, and 70s vintage design. If you ask our boss Pepe, who's in charge of the vintage aspect of the store, he can tell you stories about how we found some of these lamps in old shops in Japan and Norway. It's all little treasures. During the daytime, our main focus is the espresso bar. So our menu is predominantly focused on coffee, though we also do provide cocktails and select craft beers during the day. Then usually after 7 p.m., Wednesday through Sunday, the main focus switches to cocktail bar. So we have trained bartenders standing in the bar. We have a very wide selection of alcohols, both foreign and Japanese, which we use. The coffee is all Nordic style. We roast our own coffee now in Tokyo. We used to import from Norway, but we now roast ourselves. It's all light roast, very carefully selected beans. And since our roastery is located right up the road from the cafe, we can always maintain freshness in what we use. We currently have four types of filter coffee and one espresso, but it's always on rotation. We always try to keep it seasonal. And it's not just espresso drinks, it's a lot of filter coffee. We noticed that there's a lot of interest in both AeroPress and hand drip coffee. For the hand drip, we use Kalita wave drippers. Kalita is a Japanese coffee maker which is currently gaining a lot of renown abroad. For the Kalita and the AeroPress, we let the customers choose which beans they would like to use from our menu. We currently have two Kenyans, one Ethiopian, and one Guatemalan. Especially the Kenyan and the Ethiopian ones, the African beans tend to have a lot of fruit flavor, which works really well with the light roast. We have a small selection of pastries roasted by Jiyogoka Bake Shop, which is a bake shop in Tokyo which we have a close connection with. And then we also do have a small sandwich menu, but rather than providing food, we tend to focus on the drinks, and we also let our customers bring their own food, which is very unique in Tokyo. Not a lot of cafes do that. It's nice because especially the area that we're located in has a lot of really good bake shops and a lot of really good cafes and restaurants that do takeout. So we can kind of combine our coffee with whatever the customers want to eat. The area is a very quiet neighborhood considering the location, because we're literally 10 minutes away from Shibuya, which is one of the more busy neighborhoods in the city. But it's quiet, it's residential, it's filled with these tiny little bakeries basically out of someone's house. So it's a wonderful neighborhood to be in. Can I say that the Prime Minister rides by in his car sometimes? No, the Prime Minister lives up the road, so sometimes he drives by. Suddenly everything will turn really, really quiet, and you'll see these security guards walking up and down the road, and there he passes by.
You know, when customers come in for the first time, they see a menu with a lot of things that are unfamiliar to them. How do you steer them?
I tend to steer them towards, if they like black coffee, if they're okay with black coffee, then today what we select for today's coffee is just a really good starting point because it is one of our beans, so it gives them an impression of the sort of light roast, the Nordic style light roast that we work with. Otherwise, if they're a bit more adventurous, the Kalita Wave and the AeroPress, because that gives them the selection of four beans. For customers who are really unfamiliar with the acidity of light roast and tend to want something milder, it's easier to recommend like a milk-based espresso drink because it tends to go down easier. So like a cappuccino or a caffè latte. If someone's really, really adventurous, then I guess an espresso con panna, which I don't think you see that often in coffee shops in Tokyo. So it's a single or double shot of espresso, and then under the natural crema that forms on the espresso, we pour in fresh cream. It's a very technical little maneuver with a spoon and some whipped cream. It's a lot fuller in flavor, but I think when you manage to get the cream underneath the crema, it also lets the customer taste both the espresso and the cream separately, whereas the macchiato tends to be more of a mix already.
And that was barista Natasha Vik from Fuglen, neighbours of Monocle's new Tokyo bureau. Now it's time for a bit of music here on Midori House, maintaining the Norwegian theme established by the previous item. This is Røyksopp. Røyksopp with Robin and Every Little Thing. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now as we approach the end of the show for our daily arts review. Today, Ashanti Omkar from the BBC Asian Network is back to talk Bollywood again. The first film you want to talk about, it's not new. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
Absolutely. A thousand days and still going.
This is am I right in saying it's now the longest box office run in Indian history?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're spot on that.
A thousand weeks, in fact, not yes. A thousand days.
Sorry, a thousand weeks.
A thousand
right.
days in itself would have been impressive. A thousand
it would
weeks,
have been.
By definition, seven times more impressive. What is the film?
It is Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge, which means the brave-hearted will catch the bride, basically.
So the brave-hearted will catch the bride. I haven't seen it myself, but would I be correct in surmising that at some point there is somebody brave-hearted takes away a bride?
So Shah Rukh Khan, who is arguably one of the biggest stars in the world, and he comes from the Bollywood fraternity, he and Kajol are the pair that romance each other in this film. And he's the brave-hearted man who captures everyone's hearts. And this kind of also propelled him to super success from being kind of this kind of dark, negative character in previous films to becoming the romantic hero.
What is it about this film that's made it such a success? I mean, a thousand weeks at the box office, how many? That's 20 years.
Yeah, that's right. That's
getting, I mean, is there anyone left in India who hasn't seen it?
No, people go back to see it again and again. College students go there. Like, they've got this 11:30 showing at this one cinema. And it's apparently sold out nearly every time because they go to romance, you know, their partners. They go to propose there. There was this one story of this couple that the guy took her there 25 days in a row and then after that decided to propose to her.
He took a girl to the same film 25 yes. days in a row.
Yes, this is what I heard today on a live stream between Shah Rukh Khan and Kajol straight from Mumbai.
She's clearly not a woman who prizes imagination in a future, in a future husband. We do have a clip of this. We should hear a bit of it.
जब से तुम मुझे मिले हो मुझे परेशान किए जा रहे हो
बड़े-बड़े देशों में ऐसी छोटी-छोटी बातें होती रहती हैं अगर ये तुझे प्यार करती है तो ये पलट के देखेगी
A clip there from Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge. Did I pronounce that even? Was that
you
even,
did it really
close?
Well.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, by the law of averages, if I've done my maths right, I'm literally the only person on earth who hasn't seen it. But I dare say it will run for a while longer yet. You also want to talk about a newer film. This is Lingar.
That's right. So I saw the first day, first show at the O2 yesterday, alongside a tiny baby, a couple of little children, and a very full house. They put on a special showing. There was even this thing thing called a Palabhishegam not at the O2, luckily, but a Palabhishegam in Tamil is basically where there's a poster, a standee of the actor Rajinikanth,
like a cutout.
A cutout, exactly.
I've always wanted a cutout.
Well, and basically at this one cinema in East Ham, they actually poured milk over the cutout, like they do to like the Lord Ganesh in a temple.
That's not like a heckle, is it? That's a good thing, pouring milk in this context.
Yes, it is.
The cutout is the dream. I have been on at Monocle 24 for a cardboard cutout of me in the lobby for years. It is almost as if nobody pays any attention to me around here sometimes. Lingar is a huge release, not just in India, but outside as well. Who is likely to see it? Is this... Do big Bollywood hits like this, do they tend to play to the Indian diaspora outside India, or are there any indications that other people are now going to see the films?
Well, because there aren't press screenings for most of these films, it's very hard to get a mainstream reviewer to actually watch the film. But there is an interest all around. So a lot of the mainstream press will cover this film and they'll give it their reviews, for example. And superstar Rajinikanth has this massive draw, and they've picked one of the top actresses in Bollywood to be his second. Well, there are two heroines. So she's like the second heroine in this film, or you can look at her as the first heroine, Sonakshi Sinha. And she's been in that 100 crore club in Bollywood, which is the much lauded club that everybody wants to be in. So most of her films hit that club, and most of Rajinikanth's films just blow up. I mean, there was this Japanese family who went to Chennai just to watch this film, because in Japan, Rajinikanth is massive. So there is a crossover. The Japanese are definitely watching these films. And in China, too, there's a big crossover where Indian films are doing really well.
Okay, well, we have a clip from Lingar.
இதுதான் நாளைக்கு உங்களுடைய பொழைப்பு, தொழில், சோறு, இடம், உடை, சந்தோஷம் எல்லாம்.
என் பேரு லக்ஷ்மி சார்.
ஐயா, இது பொம்பளையே இல்லப்பா.
That's a clip from Lingar, the second selection from our Bollywood film reviewer, Ashanti Omkar. Finally, we need to talk about PK, which is again a huge release, as I understand it. Is it any good?
Well, I have not seen it yet. We will all see it at the cinema next week when it comes out, because, again, we don't get
here,
to see this.
It says here, out on the 19th, which, if I was paying any attention, I would have known. Apologies. But
that's
okay. What do we know about it?
Well, what we know is there's quite a lot of speculation, because the initial teaser trailer, which was just one clip of Aamir Khan, so he's one of Bollywood's biggest stars. He was in Dhoom 3, which kind of made lots of waves, and I'm sure I came and spoke about it with you last year.
Recall that, yes.
So Aamir Khan is in this kind of deserted area near some train tracks, and he's completely naked with just an old transistor stereo covering his modesty. And this is how this film started its promotional output.
Okay, well, we can't unfortunately bring listeners the visual of that, but we do have a clip.
Are pehchane nahi kaam ka? Hum PK hu PK.
नमूना नमूना समझते हो ना सैंपल सैंपल था वो हेडलाइट सी आंखें थी और फ्लाइंग सॉसर जैसे कान उसके सतरंगी कपड़े और उसका अतरंगी डांस.
Now, there is, as I understand it, an element of religious satire in this one.
Yes, that's right. We're looking to, well, we will all find out on the 19th. But generally, what they're trying to do is to look at this idea of Godman, which is very, very common in India, and have this guy questioning it. So we don't know whether this guy's an amnesiac who had a drinking problem, because PK means tipsy, or whether he's an alien who landed, who's then asking questions about this world and about God. God and the whole kind of existential kind of crisis, I suppose.
Is that likely to attract any controversy at all? There are some faiths not known for a sense of humor when it comes to people making fun of them.
Yes, I think it would be treated very sensitively. The team behind this film, like the director Rajkumar Hirani, for example, has actually proven that he hasn't got into a lot of controversy with stuff like this. So I think they would have treated whatever questions they're asking very sensitively.
Okay, that's PK, out on December 19th. Ashanti Omkar, thank you as ever for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Martin Plaut and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. The show
show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Up after the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley, you can hear Marcus with The Menu, Monocle's food and drink programme. At 2200, I'll be back for the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.
London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.